David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David. What's new?
Hey, Rob. Well, I've got three very interesting stories for you. We've got a story on killer ozone, another one on monkey tantrums, and finally a story about a potential major flaw with futuristic eye scanners.
Killer ozone. Is this ozone like in the ozone layer?
Well, it's the same chemical, but the ozone in the ozone layer we often think of as protective. It protects us from the sun's UV rays. But the ozone we're talking about in this study has to do with ground-based ozone.
A pollutant.
It is a pollutant, and it's actually not what they call a primary pollutant. So your car, for example, doesn't emit ozone, but it emits other chemicals that react with sunlight to create ozone. So they call it a secondary pollutant. But it's a pollutant nonetheless, and researchers I've been trying to figure out how harmful is it to us? Is it as harmful as a lot of the other pollutants you would find in a major city?
So this is why they have those ozone alerts some days when they say, okay, everybody stop driving.
Exactly. And so there is the feeling that it is harmful. And in fact, some studies with lab animals have shown that it creates inflammation in the airways, and it can also lead to asthma and other lung problems. So it seems to be dangerous, but there really hasn't been a big comprehensive study to show what effect ozone really has on human health.
Until now.
So this study is really big. They actually tracked about 500,000 people. And these were actually people that were part of another study dealing with cancer prevention. So the ozone people just took this data, and these people lived in about 100 different U.S. cities. And some of these cities had really high ozone levels, like Riverside, California, and some had low ozone levels, like San Francisco. And what they found is that for every increase in ozone of 10 parts per billion in a city, the risk of death from some sort of lung problem increased 2.9%.
So how long did they follow this group of people, and how many people are we talking about then?
Well, Rob, they followed these people for about 18 years. And over that period, about 10,000 people died from respiratory causes. So they had a lot of good data. And what they found is if you compare those cities like Riverside with the high ozone and San Francisco with the low ozone, people were three times more likely to die from lung disease in Riverside than they were in San Francisco.
That sounds fairly significant, but we're still talking low numbers of people, right?
Overall, this is still a low number, and these are sort of modest increases for the amount of increase in ozone that you're seeing. So clearly, there's a lot of other factors that contribute to lung disease and, you know, lung and cardiovascular problems. But what this study is showing is that ozone truly is a risk factor, and that it can cause these sorts of problems. And we just didn't really have this comprehensive data before.
So as you say, this is the first study, so we'll be looking for confirmatory studies to come.
Exactly. And the reason that's important is because if it turns out that ozone is this real problem, then the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. and other regulatory agencies around the world would ostensibly want to try to find a way to limit ozone levels in cities to protect the populations.
Okay, so next to monkey tantrums. What kind of monkeys and why are they throwing tantrums?
Well, Rob, this has to deal with rhesus macaques. And any parent who's had a young child in a grocery store knows that it can be really embarrassing if your kid, say, wants a piece of candy and you say, I'm not going to buy that for you. And they start flailing their arms and screaming and spinning around on the floor. And you've got all these people standing around you. And it's just embarrassing. It's a bad scene for everyone.
So we're talking about young monkeys, too.
Well, we're talking about young monkeys. And it turns out this scene actually plays out in monkey societies when a young monkey, say, wants to nurse and his mother is ignoring him, he can throw a tantrum very similar to what a human child might throw. And it's actually really annoying to listen to. Here's just a clip of a young macaque throwing a tantrum.
Oh, yeah.
And you can actually see a video of this on the site as well. It's pretty impressive.
That's really annoying. So how do the mothers react to that?
Well, it actually turns out that a lot of the time they just ignore their kids. In fact, in this new study, the researchers followed a group of monkeys that live on an island off the coast of Puerto Rico. And I think they followed about 11 females and their kids and a lot of the other monkeys in the community. And what they saw was that when these young monkeys started throwing tantrums, about 40 to 50% of the time, the mothers wouldn't do anything. And this was usually in cases when their mother was alone and the young monkey started throwing a tantrum, or when the mother was maybe surrounded by some close relatives. So almost half the time, the mother's really ignoring that.
So what happens in society? Might give in a little easier? Is that the idea?
Well, it's kind of the idea, though. It's a much more dramatic example. Imagine your kid is having a tantrum in the grocery store, and everybody around you starts beating you up.
No.
That's essentially what happens here when a mother is with her young one. The young one starts throwing a tantrum, and she's surrounded by other monkeys who aren't close relatives and who are usually higher in the pecking order than she is. All of a sudden, these monkeys will start attacking the mother, attacking the child, biting them, scratching them, pushing and pulling them.
The child, too.
The child, too. And so what the researchers found is that sort of as a preemptive, as a way to avoid this, when the mother is around these individuals and her baby starts throwing a tantrum, she's much more likely, in fact, she's about 80% likely to quiet the child down, to start nursing the child, to do anything she can to prevent the young monkey from throwing a tantrum.
And so keeping from being kicked and scratched and things like that.
Exactly.
Do the researchers have any idea why the other monkeys would be violent towards the mother and the child?
Well, you know, in studies like this, we like to say that maybe there's an evolutionary reason. Maybe, you know, that the monkeys just are trying to protect themselves from predators and they don't want loud noises. But in fact, the researcher says in this case, maybe the other monkeys just find the sound really annoying. And you might too. Listen again.
Yeah, although if I heard that in a grocery store, I'd be a little worried. So last then, eye scanning. I remember seeing this in some movie a couple of years ago. Minority Report, was that it?
Right. That was the one with Tom Cruise. And actually, it's been in a lot of, you know, so-called futuristic movies where someone will maybe go up to the door of a secure compound and all of a sudden a red beam will flash onto their eyes and scan their retina and then they'll be granted access or maybe denied access to the compound.
There was even a James Bond movie about this.
Exactly. And it turns out this technology is actually really not that futuristic. There are a number of airports that are actually employing it now, and it's becoming more popular as a way to really recognize people and for security applications. And what researchers say is it's actually a lot more accurate than, say, fingerprinting, and obviously a lot more immediate. Fingerprinting has an error rate of about 1 in 100,000, and this eye scanning has an error rate of only about 1 in a million.
1 in a million still seems like a pretty big number, given all the people that travel.
That's true, but it's really the best technology we would have right now. But you raise a good point that there are limits to this technology. And one of the big limits that researchers have been worried about is, what if there's something wrong with your eye? What if you have an eye infection or you even have like an eye disease like glaucoma or cataracts? Since this technology is so dependent on what your eye looks like, will somebody who develops this disease all of a sudden not be recognizable by these eye scanners?
Well, how does this exactly work? You said it scans your eye. How much of a match does it need with what it's got stored before it says, you are you?
Well, this is how it works. It scans your whole eye, eyelashes and all, but then it erases everything except for your iris. And this is the colored part of your eye around your pupil. And it turns this image of your iris into a numerical code. And then it stores this code so that when you come back to the machine again, it scans your eye, takes your iris code and compares it to what it has on file. And as long as there's a pretty good match, it doesn't actually have to be 100% match. And it actually can rarely be 100% match because changes in lighting or changes in your pupil dilation can change the way your iris looks. But as long as there's a pretty good match, the system will recognize you. But that's the concern with these diseases, because these diseases can change the way your iris looks potentially. So are they going to muck up this technology?
Do all eye diseases affect the ability of this system?
Well, no. It turns out that researchers only found one condition that seems to be problematic. And this is a condition called iritis, which causes an inflammation of the iris that actually distorts what the iris looks like. And you can see a pretty interesting picture of this on the site. And the researchers found that when patients had iritis and then they got scanned and they had their iritis cured, so their iris is returned to normal, the machines didn't recognize them anymore. And what was surprising is a lot of other eye problems, like we mentioned, like conjunctivitis or glaucoma, didn't affect the machine's ability to read eyes. It was just iritis.
How often does iritis occur in people?
Well, that's the problem. It has an incidence rate of about 1 in 1,000. So it's actually not that rare. And you can imagine, if with that many people, and as you said, with so many people going through, say, airports or border crossings or whatever, it could potentially be a real problem for these systems.
So 1 in 1 million accuracy rate by these eye scanners, 1 in 1,000 chance of a person having iritis. It sounds like fingerprints may not be so bad after all as identification.
Well, right. And it's not perfect. And obviously researchers are going to keep on working to optimize these systems. But it's always important to have a backup.
Yeah, I still carry around my ID.
There you go.
Okay, so what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, on Science Now, we're looking into a new super battery and another item about how memories are formed. And for the Science Policy blog, our science policy guru here, Eli Kintish, is actually in Copenhagen at an international climate conference. And this is a bunch of scientists and politicians getting together to try to come up with a policy for how individual nations can tackle climate change. So be sure to check that out on the site.
David, thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link for the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.